The Chief Judge and Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good afternoon. With the bailiff calling the court to order, this classroom at the Pettit College of Law has been changed into a federal courtroom. So it's just like you're sitting in any federal circuit court or any federal court for that matter. I'm sure that Mr. DeCicco said that we would appreciate it that if you exhibit the decorum that you would regularly exhibit in a courtroom while a case is going on. Today's case is the United States versus Herman. Are the parties ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, we'll hear first from the appellant.
Chief Judge Ehrman, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Patrick Scuderi, and along with Captain Cody Donovan Cheek, we represent Sergeant Jared Herman. Your Honor, the government failed to prove that Sergeant Herman's actions were likely to cause death or grievous bodily harm because they failed to demonstrate that it was likely that the reserve chute would be needed and it would fail. The ultimate standard from Gutierrez, Your Honor, is the plain English definition of likely. Likely is likely. But to put it into Gutierrez terms, the question is, was grievous bodily harm the likely consequence of appellant's act of pencil packing?
Well, Gutierrez was a different case. It was an aggravated assault case that dealt with AIDS and the difficulty of the legal system coming to grips with how to handle that when it first came out. And of course, we had our earlier case, Joseph, that had a very lax standard. And it was a very fact-specific case, and it dealt with aggravated assault. Why should we take anything from that case other than we will take the plain English meaning of the words to determine what likely means?
And that's what I'm asking the court to do, the likely from both steps in Gutierrez, that it's likely that a happenstance would occur, and it would be likely that that happenstance would cause death or grievous bodily harm.
Okay, if there's a happenstance, he falls out of the airplane and it doesn't work. Isn't the likelihood about 100%?
It's pretty close to that, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
So my argument would concentrate on the first part.
Well, problem. I assume on the other part.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I want you to respond to this, so I don't want to forget to talk to me about it. What about the inference in the president's discussion of the crime that says that when the natural and probable consequence of particular conduct would be death or grievous bodily harm, it may be inferred that the means of force is likely to produce that result.
And, Your Honor, that was the definition from the president's that was linked to 128 that the Army Court said was intrinsically linked, that the definition of likely should be the same for 128 and 134, that they should be the same definition. Does that answer the court's question?
But the problem I thought in Gutierrez was that the cases prior to Gutierrez was that they had adopted a lesser standard, which is that it just had to be not fanciful.
Yes, Your Honor.
It had to be something more than fanciful, and our concern that was being held to be legally sufficient, even when testimony would be that there's like a 1 in 50,000 chance that this would happen.
Yes, Your Honor. So long as the magnitude of harm was high, the likelihood of harm could be mere fanciful. But this court.
That's what we rejected.
Yes, Your Honor. By making the two-prong approach in Gutierrez, that both the happenstance and the occurrence of the grievous bodily harm would both have to be likely. And when coming to the decision on the first prong.
You said likely means likely. But we've got the CCA telling us that's the lower court below us, saying that's not helpful to us. So. How do we translate likely?
One way, Your Honor, is from the language from Weatherspoon. Weatherspoon was discussing the second prong of Gutierrez, whether or not grievous bodily harm was likely. And they said under Article 128, the likelihood of death or grievous bodily harm must be probable. It follows it is insufficient for more to prove merely that death or grievous bodily harm was possible. So a similar word to likely would be probable. And I'd urge the court to go to more likely than not under the likely standard.
Under that theory, the typical example that's given for this is, you know, someone has a gun. There's one round in a six-chamber gun. And everyone, I think, agrees that even though there's only a 1 in 6 chance that it's going to be that bullet, that it's likely.
It is likely, Your Honor.
It's even likely.
And that's also tinged by the problem in Joseph with the probability of grievous bodily, death or grievous bodily harm is high, therefore likelihood could be low. There, the natural and probable consequence of that one round going off is definitely death. But we're also talking about grievous bodily harm, which is a lesser form of harm. So would that change if it was a six-chambered weapon fired at your foot or six-chambered weapon fired at a small crowd of people in a large field?
But how does that help you in relation to your concession to Judge Stuckey that if you go out in an aircraft without operable parachutes, it's going to result in likely in death?
The way I like to discuss that, Your Honor, is the totality of the circumstances. So that first came up in Joseph, talking about the totality of the circumstances for figuring out if it was likely. It was used to a small extent in Gutierrez, but to a greater extent in Othier. Othier is the case where appellant was drown-proofing somebody, and the court essentially said without prior training, preparation, or physical conditioning, this act, the act of tying someone's hands behind their back and feet together and pushing them to the deep end of a pool, could have resulted in death or grievous bodily harm. But then the court caveated it by saying, however, whether the threat of death or grievous bodily harm is real or whether it is merely speculative depends on the circumstances. And the circumstances in that case were the victim was not a novice swimmer. Uthier had trained him for a day. There's a life preserver handy. Uthier is a medic. He's had plenty of swimming experience. And to take that into this case, the court has to consider the totality of the circumstances. The chance that these parachutes would get out of the chute shack, would get onto a jumper, get through JMPI, all laid out in my...
Is that your eight-step chain of causation?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe it's 8, Your Honor, but there's two I'd like to discuss. The first one is making it through the Jumpmaster pre-inspections. Now,
wait a minute, though. When you're talking about those, I believe it's 8 conditions preceding.
Yes, Your Honor.
You've got testimony from an expert in this case, the aerospace engineer, who says that one of the risks that is posed here is that the closing loop that holds in the pack tray may become loose, and anyone still on the aircraft could have their chute, their reserve chute, unintentionally deployed, and they could be extracted. So what's your point when it comes to your later conditions precedent?
Well, with the later conditions precedent under that circumstance, the court still has to ask themselves the question, is potential or possible still likely? And Mr. Whitman from Natick testified it's something that could happen, but he didn't say it was likely. And again, probability or possibility, it's not probable to happen. But even with that, Your Honor, there's still the condition precedent of making it through Jumpmaster pre-inspections. And in JA 48, each of the 14 parachutes had their closing loops, an extra knot in them, and two of them did not have an ejector spring. However, JA 48, the Jumpmaster specifically rigs in deficiencies at times so Jumpmaster students can find them, something that they'll see in the future as a real Jumpmaster on the flight line. And each of these had those pre-put in. The Jumpmaster class beforehand, for that class, they pulled some of the reserve chutes that were about to expire, rigged in the deficiencies, specifically so the Jumpmaster pre-inspections would find them, making it less likely that it would even, and not likely, that they'd even get past that Jumpmaster pre-inspection.
So they intentionally screwed them up, but that's okay because they would have gone that way, not that way, and therefore no harm, no foul. Is that what you're claiming?
Well, when trying to consider the totality of the circumstances.
Well, yeah, the totality of circumstances where if I was standing in that door, this thing was hanging on my chest, and it had little extra knots in it, was flat and not fluffy, and I knew this, well, I wouldn't go out the door. But if I didn't, I might regret it. And it seems like there's a pretty high chance of my regretting it.
I disagree with the high chance of regretting it, Your Honor. Okay. Knowing it...
Why? Because it would have been caught by the procedures?
Yes, Your Honor. And if you're standing in the door, the government put on no evidence of the likelihood of main chute failure. If the main chute operates properly, you're not going to need the reserve chute in the first place. So if the main chute
if the main chute operates properly, you're not going to need it. So why are we spending all this money on them?
On the reserve chute, Your Honor?
Yeah.
Part of the purposes for all of these checks is to instill confidence in the jumpers. When the jumper's standing in the door getting ready to jump, the last thing they want to do is question your gear. and they'll do anything they can to take a small percentage of chance off.
Well, isn't the purpose to save their lives?
Yes, Your Honor, should any of those preconditions precedent fail. And some of the scholarly literature attached to my brief discusses how small of a chance it is for it ever to happen. In the over 23,000 jumps, they never discuss any failures of any chutes. In the civilian world, there's an infinitesimally small chance that main chutes even fail.
So is this conduct beyond the reach of the law, in your opinion?
No, Your Honor. There's still dereliction of duty, and if the officer in charge of the chute shack wanted to put out an order, anybody who intentionally disobeys any of these mandatory checks and conditions in the chute shack should be subject to Article 92.
Oh, wait a minute. You got to okay. Are you saying this isn't a punitive regulation, so you've got to back it up with an order?
Yes, Your Honor. The TM is not a punitive regulation. But there is still, Sergeant Herman stands guilty today of dereliction of duty. He had a duty and he didn't do it. So that is another area of the law that covers this misconduct.
So are you saying, though, Counsel, that with this particular charge, that the government didn't prove it because the testimony was possibly, potentially, and could, those are the operative terms, or are you saying something broader than that, that the government could not have proven this case no matter what the evidence was before the court?
The problem there is, Your Honor, is we don't know what evidence is out there to prove, to demonstrate the likelihood of main chute failure, the likelihood that these deficiencies would make it through JMPI.
But I don't think you're answering my question. Are you saying the government did not prove this case? Are you saying the government, under no circumstances, could prove this charge against the accused?
I'm saying in this case, they absolutely did not prove that it could happen, that it was likely that Sergeant Herman's conduct would cause death or grievous bodily harm.
Do they have to show a percentage statistically as to what the risk would be?
No, Your Honor, it could be given in colloquial terms. There's a good chance, but saying it's possible, it's also possible to win the lottery, but no one would say it's likely. We don't know what they mean by possible. There's experts in there.
Yeah, you had somebody testifying that I saw it happen.
Once in 16 years of jumping, Your Honor. So if anything, that would show it's very unlikely for something like this to happen.
Well, then you're back in statistics.
Isn't that what fact finders are for?
Yes, Your Honor. But for instance, in Gutierrez, this court drew one line. They said if it's 1 in 500, it's definitely not likely. I don't think that a number could be put on this, or the court could give a very exact definition of what likelihood is.
Can you see Gutierrez without looking at advances in medicine between the time Johnson was decided and the time Gutierrez was decided, when the installation of the virus was an almost certain sentence to death? And by the time Gutierrez was decided, medicine had advanced a very significant distance. But here you've got the Johnson situation. If it hits you, you're dead.
I don't necessarily think you have the Johnson situation per se. In the article attached to the brief, they discussed the original jumping in the military back in the 1940s, pre-World War II, that there were more chances of people getting harmed, more chances of failures, more chances of entanglement. But through the progression of time, the likelihood prong got lower and lower through different exit techniques, parachute landing falls, and the inclusion of a reserve chute, and you saw the number drop. And it's that's similar, though, to Joseph, because back when Joseph happened, we're not sure of the efficacy of condom use, et cetera, and its use now.
So what, in your opinion, did the government need to do to meet its burden?
They had to show that every step along the way, was each of the eight steps likely, but the totality of the circumstances was likely.
Oh, I can't hear you.
But also the totality of all those steps were likely, Your Honor, because
what you want is a mathematical count. If the chance of one, it's one times two, one factorial.
Yes, Your Honor.
One times two times three times four, etc. I think I got it.
That's the way of it that I explained. I think I explained it in my brief that if everything is likely, it has to be likely for the first step, and then the percentages and the chances and the likelihood gets lower and lower and lower depending on the likelihood of each step in between. And this is a little different than Outhier, because Outhier is, they're not in series, they're in parallel, all the checks. Here, in series, you have the checks, and they're in series for a purpose, to ensure that the jumpers are confident, and they have every possibility and every chance to check any deficiency in the parachute to ensure a safe exit and a safe landing, so the sorters can go on and do their mission. Does that answer the court's question?
I think as much as it can be.
Did the defense Did the defense put on any evidence whatsoever that these things were not likely to happen? So, for example, that the chutes would not get used, that additional safeguards would be met, to counter the government's expert and other witnesses?
No, Your Honor. I think if you read the closing argument of the defense counsel, they were essentially arguing Gutierrez before Gutierrez. They were essentially arguing that the chance of even needing the reserve chute is so infinitesimally low that even if the likelihood of death or grievous bodily harm is high, you still even fail the Joseph test. So that was their argument, Your Honor,
well,
and I don't think they had it put
argument,
on.
But arguments aren't evidence. They put on any evidence.
No, Your Honor. But the government also put on no evidence that it would ever be likely for the main chute to fail, needing a reserve chute, or, Your Honor, that the reserve chute would deploy while in the aircraft. While it's possible, possible is not likely.
What about the argument that the president promulgating this in the manual specifically referred to pre-Gutierrez president?
Your Honor, first, the president had that intrinsic link between the two.
Say again?
The president specifically said there's a link between the 128 and the 134. And if the president said it. So if the definition under 128 changes, then the definition under 134 changes, Your Honor. I don't think there's anything more to be read into that. Without an express statement from the president that I want the Joseph standard, I think the standard in 128 also applies to 134.
Captain Scudieri, this is a factual question, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I just really can't remember the record. But was it clear in the record that the accused, now these shoots came from the Jumpmaster School, and there's this whole thing about the built-in deficiency?
Yes, Your Honor.
Or defect. Did the accused know that? Does the record indicate that the accused knew that when he instructed his team to not instruct him?
The record is devoid of whether he knew or didn't know, Your Honor.
And I'm not suggesting that's relevant. I just couldn't.
Subject to question to the court, I see my time's expired.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you,
Your Honor. More time, I don't know. The court will now hear from the amicus in support of the appellant.
Good afternoon, Chief Judge Erdman, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Chris Kalpin, and I am a law student acting as amicus curiae on behalf of the appellant, Sergeant Herman. I respectfully urge this court to reverse the decision of the lower court for the following two reasons.
Would you speak up a little?
Sorry, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I respectfully urge this court to reverse the decision of the lower court for the following two reasons. First, the standard as set forth by this court in the United States versus Gutierrez is the controlling standard under a charge of reckless endangerment under Article 134 of the UCMJ. And second, the lower court misapplied this standard despite adopting it in the context of reckless endangerment. Now, moving to my first point, and as the counsel's appellant has pointed out, the president clearly indicated in the manual for courts martial that the definition of likely to produce in the context of the Article 128 UCMJ aggravated assault is the same definition to be used in Article 134 of the UCMJ for a charge of reckless endangerment. Now, furthermore, the lower court did correctly point out that there is a definitional consistency both within the MCM as well as in this court's jurisprudence. In the United States versus Gutierrez, this court stated that an aggravated assault or likely to produce under aggravated assault under Article 128 cannot mean one thing there and something different throughout the statutes. And the lower court adopted this reasoning, applying the definition of likely conduct likely to produce in the context of a 134 reckless assault or reckless endangerment as well. So therefore, because of that, the standard is set forth in Gutierrez, the ultimate plain English standard, should be controlling in determining whether the conduct at issue here was likely to produce death or grievous bodily injury. Now, that brings me to my second point, which is that the lower court ultimately misapplied the judicial standard as set forth in Gutierrez. Now, there are the two-prong test in determining whether there is a reckless endangerment for likely to produce in that context is, one, a full analysis of the risk of harm, and second, a full analysis of the magnitude of harm. Now, what the lower court did was more akin to what the court's jurisprudence in Weatherspoon and Joseph, though in those cases, in which case the lower court really looked to the magnitude of the harm. Now, it wasn't disputed whether should a paratrooper be equipped with one of these defective parachutes, and should that defective parachute fail, that the paratrooper would likely suffer death or grievous bodily injury. But that goes solely to the magnitude of the harm here, and we're already dealing with the highest order of magnitude, as it's already built into a charge of reckless endangerment as death or grievous bodily injury.
I thought that what they were concerned with was what the risk was. So when you say that they misapplied 3 years, and I might say that I might agree with you that they unnecessarily complicated it, and I'm not sure that they ignored the risk of harm.
Well, Your Honor, the testimony that they...
The difference between risk of harm and magnitude of harm should the risk of harm occur.
Correct, Your Honor. And what the lower court did was really look to the what ended up being the magnitude of harm. While they did ultimately conclude that the pencil packing by appellant was likely to produce death or grievous bodily injury, they looked to the evidence from that the government put on in the testimony, which stated that should a paratrooper be equipped with one of these parachutes, should their main parachute fail, and should their reserve parachute fail because of the pencil packing, that it would be likely to produce death or grievous bodily injury.
But they did show that the chute that was the pencil pack chute that was defective was erroneously marked, that it was ready, and it was placed into the ready-to-use cage. Now, can't a juror figure out for himself or herself that if this parachute is in the ready-to-use cage, there's a good chance that it's going to be used? And how do you quantify that? I'm not sure. I don't think there can be any statistical analysis that can quantify that. But we're talking about fact finders here who aren't experts. There was no this isn't Gutierrez, because all of that was proved or established by statistics and ratios, and that's just not this case. This case is just a bunch of people assessing a risk and giving all of the inferences that we have to give to the government's case under this legal sufficiency standard. Why isn't that enough?
Right, Your Honor. And in terms of a fact finder or as a jury, for instance, it's not a question of pure mathematical possibility or statistical possibilities and that type of thing. However, what is really at issue here is that the court was looking to, the lower court was looking to the magnitude of harm in a way that was analogous to the way that HIV was looked at prior to Gutierrez.
I'm certain that could be wrong, but I mean, I thought that our concern, my concern in Dacus and that the court's concern in Gutierrez was that the risk of harm didn't matter as long as the magnitude of harm would be great, right? And so because we were faced in these HIV AIDS cases with situations where experts would testify, there's a 1 in 500,000 chance that this is gonna happen. Now if it does happen, you know, the person could die, right? But the chances of it happening there was testimony saying that it was so remote, but they acted as though that didn't matter. But I don't think we ever said that the risk couldn't be low if the magnitude of harm was great. We just said it had to be, it mattered.
It had to be there.
You know, you couldn't ignore it. Like, you couldn't ignore a statistic saying a 1 in 500,000 chance. But as we're now in a situation where there's no testimony like that whatsoever, reviewing this for legal sufficiency, which is a pretty low standard indeed, and it's that no reasonable fact finder could find that the person was guilty.
Right, Your Honor, and I was not contesting that the risk was irrelevant based on a finding of magnitude. And in fact, it is conceded that if the magnitude is high and substantial, that a low risk can still support a showing for likely to produce. However, what this court did also say in Gutierrez, citing to Dacus, was that what the case law does not say is that just because there is a high magnitude does not make the risk irrelevant. As to your point, Your Honor.
Do you read the lower court opinion?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you have a view? They talked at one point about this notion of social cost and social interest, and so they tried to make a distinction between someone, you know, riding, you know, 100 miles an hour through a busy town just to joyride, and, you know, speeding through the town to get someone to a hospital. I mean, that wasn't the exact example, but something like that. What if any part should that play in this? You know, they used, as an example in this case, you know, someone, you know, basically mislabeling parachutes, right, because they wanted to go leave work early and go have fun, versus someone like inadvertently just kind of doing it because they were rushing off to do something else important. What part of anything do you think that should play in the analysis, if any?
Sure, Your Honor. So regarding the social utility, and that is that can be an important factor to consider in cases like this. And while it is hard to concede that there was, as the lower court did point out, that there was any social utility with the pencil packing here, as the only real reason that it was done was so that they can leave early. However, while social utility can be taken into consideration by this court, it is also important to look at the risk and whether the evidence does show that there was some type, at least a risk that would be enough to allow for both risk, a finding of risk and magnitude. Now, should this court find that, and then while factoring in the social utility, then that would be one avenue. However, if, as appellant's brief stated, if the possibility for such an event to actually occur, meaning for someone to actually be equipped with one of these parachutes, should that parachute fail, is such a low probability chance, and the government, while it did put on evidence stating
how do we
that.
Know that? I mean, the appellant posits this lengthy chain of circumstances and basically says, unless the government proves beyond a reasonable doubt that 1 × 2 × 3 × 4 ... 8 comes to something over 1 in 500, they haven't proved their case. That sounds to me, number one, like a dubious proposition. I don't know where the 8 contingencies came from, other than the mind of counsel. But do you agree with what are you saying here?
Well, Your Honor, yes, I do agree with at least a full length analysis into those conditions precedent. But there was also evidence to show that main parachute failure is such a low probability chance, and I believe in the study. That was attached to appellant's brief was something like 1 in just under 64,000 military jumps ended in casualty. So the question would be whether should this risk be such that it is substantial and likely to occur. And Your Honor, I see that my time has expired. May I briefly conclude?
You can briefly conclude.
I don't mean to belabor this point, but you heard my question earlier to the appellant's counsel about the record not being clear on what or if the accused knew about these parachutes having these intentional defects. Does that matter at all, or does it intend? I mean, it's not a trick question. I just really want to know. Does it matter if he did know, or whether he didn't know, or didn't care?
Yes, Your Honor. It was unclear. I know that those parachutes were marked a specific way.
Right.
Had the appellant known, then yes, that I believe that would go to the social utility question, and I think that if this court does adopt that should be a factor taken into consideration. So
that he did not. Well, I guess we have to assume that he did not know because it's not clear in the record which would use.
Well, yes, Your Honor, there was no affirmative evidence to establish that he actually did know and deliberately disregarded that. So there would need to be a finding of that.
Yeah.
But. For the foregoing reasons, I respectfully ask this court to reverse the decision of the lower court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court will now hear from the government.
Chief Judge Erdman, judges of the court, may it please the court, my name is Major Annie Shea, and I, along with Captain Sam Landis, represent the government in this matter. This court should affirm the findings and sentence in this case for two reasons. First, this court's treatment of the likelihood element for Article 128 in United States versus Gutierrez should not reach the fence of reckless endangerment under Article 134. And second, the evidence in this case is legally sufficient to show that appellant's conduct was likely to produce death or grievous bodily harm.
Counsel, going through the record, what I could find in terms of the testimony during the court-martial were the phrases possibly, potentially, and could.
Yes, Your Honor.
Can you point to other evidence within the record that would rise to the level of likely?
The word likely was not used, Your Honor.
Is there any other evidence out there beyond possibly, potentially, and could that could equate to likely?
Well, Your Honor, there was plenty of evidence as for the natural and probable course of events of appellant's conduct in this case. As far as specific
now,
language...
That testimony was not used. Those words were not used.
Those words were not used, no, Your Honor. But again, we're looking at a legal sufficiency analysis, and so the evidence has to be viewed in light most favorable to the government, and according to the MCM, likelihood is something that can be inferred when there's evidence that the natural and probable course of events is death or grievous bodily harm.
What do you do with the fact that these deficiencies were intentionally placed within the reserve chutes that were intended to go through the Jumpmaster program for the Jumpmaster candidates to discover them? These were not hidden defects.
Your Honor, again, we don't know if all of the 14 parachutes that went through all came from the Jumpmaster course, but that was the inference that was made by the both Sergeant First Class Source and Chief Fowler, based off of their review of the parachutes, knowing that there are some that had built-in deficiencies. We do know that of the 14 parachutes that were found, there all of them had closing loop issues. Two were missing ejector springs, and there were a number of other issues such as the spreader tie bars and the frayed loops. Now,
but all of those could have been should have been. If there was a proper Jumpmaster inspection.
Not with the missing ejector springs. Those are ones that would require opening up the chute to discover. And so we know that also when they opened up two of the chutes, they saw the spreader tie bars, the canopy ties, are ones that you would have to look at inside also.
Wait,
and those were frayed.
The Jumpmaster inspection doesn't involve opening it up. What does it involve?
It involves an exterior visual inspection,
oh,
Your Honor.
You mean in other words, it's flat and not fluffy?
Well, it's just looking at the chest rig. They do a set of inspections
right
before the jumper
they
goes.
They can't see these little tie things.
They're not going to deploy
can't
the
see
parachute.
The
no, Your Honor.
And these things were tossed into the go use them cage.
Well, they were as a result of appellant's conduct. Yes,
well,
Your
that's
Honor.
That's what I mean.
Yes, Your Honor.
Following this pseudo-inspection.
Or non-inspection, yes, Your Honor.
Well, whatever you want.
Yes, Your Honor. I do want to talk briefly first about the standard of likely, because Gutierrez is a case that both amicus and appellant have heavily relied upon. And Gutierrez, again, is the case in which this court expressly overturned the proposition from Joseph and Johnson that the risk of harm must be more than fanciful, remote, or speculative. Now, the impetus for this court's decision in that case came from an analysis of Article 128. And according to Chief Judge Baker there, this definition appears to be sui generis to HIV aggravated assault cases and is not derived from the statute itself. Now, we have to understand that what we have before us today is not an aggravated assault case, but a case of reckless endangerment. And so the government would ask that this court conduct the same sort of analysis in determining what is the appropriate way to measure what that likelihood element is. And when we look at both the history and the intent and even the text of reckless endangerment under Article 134, we see that Joseph and Johnson standard about the risk of harm is not wholly inappropriate. And in fact, it's supported by jurisprudence across the nation as to reckless endangerment. And so to go briefly into the offense, we know that when the President enumerated reckless endangerment in 1999, it relied on two authorities. One was the 1989 case of United States versus Woods, which was perhaps ironically enough a deathly STD case, and then the other one was the Maryland statute.
What does it mean to say that the Maryland statute is a gap-filling incohate, perhaps doubly incohate crime?
Well,
I'm baffled. What does that mean?
Your Honor, that phrase comes from Williams versus Maryland, which is a Maryland case.
But what does it mean?
It means that, and the Maryland court explains this, that at both the mens rea level and the actus reus level, it is one step short of aggravated assault. And so you don't have a consummated harm yet, and nor do you have the specific intent that is required for aggravated assault.
Well, the argument that you're making about likely means likely different things in different situations was not adopted by the lower court, and that's the opinion that you are here to like represent and defend. And you know, the fact that, you talked about likely meaning less, meaning more than fanciful and remote, not being the standard in our 128 doesn't mean that we thought it was a standard here. I mean, do you need to make that argument to win this case?
No, Your Honor, not with this specific case. But I do believe when you're looking at the application of Gutierrez, it's important to understand the limitations of Gutierrez, and to look again when we're looking
can
at this
you,
case.
Can you just move on and pretend that we don't agree with you, and that Gutierrez that likely means likely. Means the same thing for both statutes?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. And with this particular case, we know that the government's proved a set of facts. For one, the conduct itself, that appellant deliberately instructed his subordinates to pencil pack these parachutes, and they in fact failed to inspect them and then sign them off as if they were properly packed. We also know that they certainly led to deficient parachutes, 14 of which were found in this case. And again, as I described the deficiencies, they had closing loop issues, missing ejector springs, and other deficiencies. We also know from the testimony of Sergeant First Class Doris that these parachutes were, in fact, in the ready-for-issue cage, and they would have been used in airborne operations. Now,
well, how do we know that in light of the fact that those chutes had been in the ready-to-use cage before and had not been used during the 365-day cycle? So how does the government know, based on their record, that those chutes would have been used the next 365 days?
I think it's a reasonable inference that can be made by the fact finder from the normal course of events for these parachutes, Your Honor. We do know that
tell me where in the record that is. Because like I said, my reading of the record is that those chutes had not been used in the last 365-day cycle. So where in the record does it say that they would have been used in the next 365-day cycle before they would have been popped and repacked and inspected again?
Well, Your Honor, the primary evidence we have, again, is from Sergeant First Class Doris. That's JA 50 to 51, in which he stated that these deficient parachutes were in the ready-for-issue cage and would have been used in airborne operations. He doesn't go into specifics, and that is lacking from the record, Your Honor. But again, that is not the standard that is required of the government. And we know that Sergeant First Class Doris also testified as to when a reserve is needed, and he gave a couple of different scenarios. One, when you have a malfunction of the main chute, which is the course of events that appellant relies upon, your canopy either fails to deploy, or you have a mid-air collision, or basically, if your rate of descent is faster than your fellow jumper, then you will deploy your T-11 reserve. That comes from JA 30, again, Sergeant First Class Doris' testimony. We also know.
Would be a different case if, in response to this evidence by the government, the defense had put on evidence, right, that there was like, you know, a one in 20,000 chance or a one in 20,000 chance that these parachutes were already used.
Your Honor, perhaps so.
Yes,
Your Honor, the government could come forth with rebuttal evidence as far as numbers to perhaps rebut that evidence. Again, and this goes back to the first part of my argument, I understand the court disagrees with
picking a number. The 20,000 isn't like a talismanic number, it was just a number that I picked.
Yes, Your Honor. We know also from Mr. Whiteman's testimony that how each of these specific deficiencies could have resulted in death or grievous bodily harm. One is the one that you discussed earlier, which is the closing loop issues that would have created a potentially an unintended deployment or a premature deployment, which would cause death or grievous bodily harm to the soldier who is waiting on the aircraft or the soldiers around him at any point in that airborne operation. Now, appellant, of
and
course,
the point there is there would not have been a need to have the main chute malfunction. It would simply
yes,
be,
Your Honor.
Based on the evidence in the record from the aerospace engineer, is having the closing loop stretched out because they'd been in there for 365 days. The mere force of the air within the aircraft could have caused that reserve chute to pop.
Yes, Your Honor. The argument is that there are multiple ways to get to the death or grievous bodily harm of these soldiers, and the government presented multiple different scenarios in which this could have happened through expert testimony. I think it's also important to consider the inherent risk of the activity here, that these airborne operations already involve that threshold risk or death or grievous bodily harm. So even when parachutes are working properly, people still die or incur grievous bodily harm jumping out of airplanes.
Does that hurt or help your argument?
It could.
You're saying it's a naturally dangerous activity.
Yes, Your Honor. And
so how does that help you?
It helps me you consider what reckless endangerment is meant for. And so in this particular case, we know that what appellant had a duty here to inspect, to conduct those 9 rigor checks that were associated with this parachute and ensure that it was airworthy and that he deliberately failed each of those steps. And when you know that the specific purpose of a legal duty is to prevent death or grievous bodily harm, and that in itself is omitted or someone fails to do that, that falls well within what most states across the country consider reckless endangerment. And so, again, I understand that this court would like to hold a definition of likely that corresponds with both Article 128 and 134 based off of that definitional link. But I would propose that, first of all, when a president enumerates an Article 134 offense, that is persuasive authority for this court, and this court should interpret this offense in the context, in the historical context of what reckless endangerment is intended for. And
do you have an answer to Judge Sparks' question that he's posed to the other counsel about whether there's evidence in the record that the appellant knew when you think about these shoes?
Your Honor, there wasn't direct evidence, but we know from Sergeant Forsyth's source that he had marked the JMPI parachutes with red tape. He stated that, and then he threw them into the set of parachutes that were to be repacked. And so there's no evidence as whether or not that red tape was removed or not at any point. That may have been indicated to appellant that he knew. But again, no direct evidence as to that fact.
So, counsel, just so I'm clear, I know you addressed this. What's the government's position in terms of what we should be instructing a panel about what likely or likelihood means in the reckless endangerment context?
In the reckless endangerment context, Your Honor, I do think it's important. The Army Corps calls it social utility, but when you look at, for example, the Maryland offense on which this offense was based, there is something important about in considering the lack of justification or the unnecessary nature of that risk being taken as far as evaluating how high that risk needs to be. And so essentially the risk of harm can be low when there is absolutely no justification. In fact, in a case like this one, a legal duty to prevent that known risk.
Okay, but I'm not sure you've answered my question. You're saying the risk can be low, but I'm asking, in terms of we've got the panel there deciding the case, what type of instruction should be given to them when they're trying to decide what constitutes likely or likelihood?
Your Honor, the government would ask for a definition that is similar to the one of the Maryland offense, which is a quantitatively substantial and qualitatively unjustified risk. Or again, this comes from the MCM, a substantial risk, an unjustified and substantial risk of death or grievous bodily harm. And again, the risk certainly does matter, as this court has stated in United States versus Dacus and again in Gutierrez. So we're not saying the risk doesn't matter, but the risk can potentially be a low one when you consider the conduct that is actually involved and the justification involved in that conduct.
Well, doesn't that back away from the Gutierrez?
Yes, Your Honor, and that is why in the government's position is that Gutierrez.
What you really want us to do is say Gutierrez doesn't apply.
Yes, Your Honor, Gutierrez doesn't apply.
If we say Gutierrez applies, do you lose?
No, Your Honor, we do not lose this case.
Tell me why.
Again, based off of the evidence in this case and the evidence that's required, we know that likelihood, pre-Gutierrez and post-Gutierrez, is that likelihood is something that can be inferred from the evidence of the natural and probable course of events. And here we have a course of events that the government proved that death or grievous bodily harm was indeed a likely consequence of appellant's conduct.
I don't see how you're backing up 2 years by the standard you just proposed.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I said I don't understand how you're backing away from Gutierrez with the standard that you
Oh, no, Your Honor. I was, again, just answering Judge Stuckey's question, that under the Gutierrez standard.
Judge Stuckey's question was, isn't that back and away from Gutierrez? And you said yes. And I'm saying, I don't understand how it is.
Well, I thought she was saying, yeah, we'd like you to back, but if you don't back, we still win because.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
Now,
so our,
my problem is, I don't understand what you just said.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm sorry that I'm unclear. Our first position, Your Honor.
Basically, all you did was throw around likely and maybe and sort of.
Yeah, because I mean, Gutierrez always said is, you know, if you say that the likelihood of risk is almost zero, that doesn't cut it, right? That's what we said.
Your Honor.
We didn't say it has to be some talismanic number. We just said if it's almost zero, right, that falls into the fanciful, and then that's not good enough.
Yes, Your Honor. And the government would agree with that,
saying, I think, that it's not almost zero.
The government in this case, Your Honor?
Yeah.
Your Honor, we have, again, if you consider what reckless endangerment cases and how they're proven, you're not going to get a specific number or really any meaningful number as to that probability. And again, I would ask this court to look at some of the Maryland cases in which they have said that what a qualitatively substantial risk means, it doesn't require the risk be almost certain or that there is even a heavy probability.
But getting back to Judge Stuckey's question, is as I understand your position, you're saying that the risk is something greater than zero.
Yeah.
And it is certainly something that is.
The de minimis we said wasn't enough in Gutierrez.
It is a real, yes, Your Honor, it's a real substantial risk of death or grievous bodily harm here. We don't have a specific number.
It's greater than zero.
Your Honor, the aim of reckless endangerment is two-part. One is that wanton disregard of human life, and the other is conduct that creates a substantial risk. And so for a risk to be substantial, it still needs to be considerable. And that is certainly more than zero. Pending any further questions, this court should affirm the findings and sentence in this case.
Thank you, counsel. We now have rebuttal.
Your Honor, first, my learned counsel from the government states that the only way to find out there were no springs in there would be to open the chute. It's contrary to the record. CW2 Fowler, first of all, testifies that each of the 14 parachutes were pencil packed. And of each of those 14 parachutes, he found, based on outside visual inspection, and that's in JA at 138, that each of them had deficiencies in them. There was no need to open them, particularly when the deficiencies.
Is that because they're flat and not fluffy or what?
Part because they're flat and not fluffy, Your Honor.
Okay.
But the second is because they're much thinner. Without that.
Well, it's flat and not fluffy.
Yeah. Yes, Your Honor, but it's the space between the shoes.
So what you're saying is visual inspection's enough.
Yes, Your Honor.
You don't have to go in there and look at these little ties and see if the springs are going boing.
No, Your Honor.
That's enough.
You're correct, Your Honor. The second point is, Judge Olson, I believe you're discussing the expert from Natick and the aerospace engineer about things could happen. But again, just because it could happen doesn't mean it's possible. And that's
where. If it could happen, it seems it's possible.
Or excuse me, could happen doesn't mean it's probable. Apologize, Your Honor. Because again, you could win the lottery, but doesn't mean it's possible. Or it's probable you're going to win the lottery. Sorry, I'm mixing up the words, Your Honor. And Judge Olson and Judge Stuckey, you discussed the natural and probable result as death or grievous bodily harm. Take it from 134 and 128. What that essentially does say is if it's a natural and probable consequence, it's likely. So therefore, it's got to be probable to be likely. So it's essentially.
The definition of probable?
To me, Your Honor, it's close to more probable than not, or 50%. That if it's probably going to happen.
Any jurisdiction in the entire world. That's,
no, Your Honor.
That's what probably means.
No, I do not, Your Honor. It's just a linguistic idea that if it's probable going to happen, I believe it's going to happen. And its chances of happening are less than its chance of not happening. And Judge Ryan, you discussed with Amicus the social necessity portion of the Army Court's opinion. What that I think does is social utility. Excuse me, Your Honor. What that I think conflates a little is guilt and the defense. The social utility of the conduct has nothing to do with the likelihood of the conduct. If the person was driving through the street recklessly, he's recklessly endangering the lives. But if he had a necessity or a duress, That would be a defense. The social utility has no effect on whether or not the conduct of the conduct is itself likely to cause death or grievous bodily harm. And subject any additional questions of the court?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court thanks counsel for all of the parties that argued today. The case is now submitted, and the court is adjourned until further order of the court.
The court is adjourned until further order of the court.
Okay, please be seated.
Yeah.